That's on now. So, today, lesson two, we are looking at chapter 20, canto 3,
yes.
Chapter 26, in this 11th unit, the second last unit of this module 1. So, so in this chapter, Lord Kapila describes to his mother the different stages of Sankhya, different categories of the Absolute Truth. We see how the living entity comes into the material world, develops material consciousness in association with material energy, and is awarded a set of material bodies of senses, and the presiding deities looking after those senses and sense objects. In this way, the living entity experiences different feelings of happiness and distress. So there's an explanation of such things as pradan and prakriti, very subtle forms of material energy, and all the different 24 elements of material energy, the jiva, time, the super soul, all these things are discussed.
Who is this 26th chapter, Fundamental Principles of
Material? Yes. The Mahatattva, the false ego, all these things are discussed.
It says, I think it says Yonir Mahatattva, what, 24 elements.
Yes.
Different time of the year.
And that's right.
Yeah.
And, you know, that though all those different ingredients come together to form the universal egg, and gradually there was the appearance of the universal form.
Yeah.
And, the universal form is finally aroused by the presence of the super soul. So, now, those who have studied, Canto 2, they will have come across some of these concepts previously. Let us begin. So Lord Kapila tells his mother, Devahuti, that he's going to describe the different categories of the Absolute Truth, knowing which any person can be released from the influence of the modes of material nature. He then says that knowledge, so he's giving her knowledge, and this knowledge is the ultimate perfection of self-realization, and I shall explain that knowledge to you, which cuts the knots of attachment to the material world. So he's going to explain to her knowledge of Atma, which actually refers to the Supreme Lord. Atma in this case refers to the Super Soul. There is the energy which is controlled, the material energy which is controlled by the Super Soul, and the living entities which are also under the control of the Super Soul. There is knowledge of the Supreme Lord, and all the various categories of that absolute personality of Godhead. What is the result? That we're able to get a clear distinction of the difference between the Supreme Lord and the material elements, and between the soul, the individual souls, and the material elements. That is the benefit. So Prabhupada, if we ask the question, what is the result of understanding Sankhya philosophy? There are many diverse departments of knowledge. This is what Srila Prabhupada says in his purport to verse 1. In understanding Krishna, and Sankhya philosophy is especially meant for persons who are conditioned by this material world. It is generally understood by the Parampara system to be the science of devotional service. And therefore those preliminary studies of devotional service have already been explained in the previous chapter. So, now, but more specifically, if we wanted to answer the question, what is the result of understanding Sankhya philosophy? The main thing is that by such an analytical study, one becomes free from the modes of material nature. That's the real point. That's the main point there. By studying this, we become free from the modes of material nature. That same conclusion is there in the Bhagavad Gita. So it's meant for the conditioned souls, because becoming free from the modes of material nature helps them to come to the platform that they can understand that they should take up devotional service and do that with determination. As we know, devotional service begins, as mentioned in 1854, properly when one is actually beyond the modes of material nature. Liberated, a humble Muslim. Becoming free from the modes of material nature means, of course, one sees oneself as different from the material energy. One sees oneself as the eternal servant of the Lord. So one is self-realized and is able to cut the knot. Become detached from material energy, which is different from oneself. So to isolate the soul, the living entity, from those other categories of material nature. So now, of course, we should also understand that that doesn't mean that if someone is already a devotee, they don't need to study Sankhya philosophy. Because, of course, the devotees have to teach Sankhya philosophy. So they have to know it, because otherwise who's going to teach Sankhya philosophy? Only a devotee, really, one has to... this system is explained by the Lord and his representatives, and understood by the Lord and his representatives. So devotees have to understand this philosophy if they want to teach it to others. Even for devotees, quite often people come to devotional service, they're engaged in devotional service, they don't need the preliminary prerequisite of knowledge. Here, generally people take the step-by-step process and they gradually elevate, come to the platform of knowledge, and then they may take the devotional service as a result of a proper understanding and good association. By the grace of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, we're just given the opportunity to directly take the devotional service, And then we're given the opportunity that while we're engaged in devotional service for that proper knowledge to mature. Anyway, so that's another reason that we should still, you know, study the philosophy of Sankhya, even though we're engaged in devotional service. It's almost like, eating sweets first and you can eat the vegetables later. So,
Is it that normally,
Yes.
Normally we, of course, as you said, by the mercy of Mahaprabhu, we are already engaging in devotional service and letting this knowledge mature, but is it otherwise that it's done the other way around, like in the earlier ages,
Generally people perform Karma Yoga, and from that, after many hundreds of years, lifetimes, the purification of Karma Yogi kicks in, and they gradually realize what they're doing. You know, in the beginning, it's like, you know, if I chant these prayers and do this ritual with the priest, you know, I'll get these benefits and I might go to heaven afterwards. And then, you know, after many, many lifetimes of that, one starts to think, well, you know, if I've done that for many millions of lifetimes, and I go to heaven, I've got to come back, maybe there's a more permanent situation of reality existence. So they then aspire for knowledge. How do I get out of this process of up and down in the material world? So then that's Sankhya. You know, one becomes a jnani. And one may practice that. If one puts that knowledge into practical application, one will practice yoga in order to, because the result of jnana is that one tries to detach, one tries to control the mind and senses, and that is the practice of yoga, to fix the mind upon, fix the mind, and the mind is fixed upon the Supreme, and the mind and the senses are, linked with the Supreme. So, so that's the general process. So therefore you see that this Sankhya philosophy, in different verses, is described that it's performed along with different mystic yoga practices. You know, it's the Sankhya, the mystic yoga practice, and it should have some devotional, bhakti, otherwise it will not produce, the results, because jnana and yoga and karma cannot produce a result without bhakti. There must be some bhakti. But in the previous chapter, the Kapila has said that actually, gradually you should, by Sankhya you take up, you should have knowledge and renunciation. And that should help you to appreciate that, the path of bhakti, and you should, take up bhakti. Ultimately, you should just perform pure bhakti, not desire any benefit. You should not desire from jnana liberation. And you should not desire from yoga mystic cities, but they should be just concomitant factors of bhakti, where there is no desire other than to please the Lord in pure bhakti. So, that was explained in the previous chapter. That ultimately you should just come for pure bhakti. That is that's the topmost realization. And if one is practicing pure bhakti yoga, as described in the previous chapter, the Lord automatically awards those persons all the results of karma, yoga, and jnana, plus the results of bhakti, and allows them to go back to the spiritual world. So even though the devotee is performing pure devotional service and then not desiring anything, the Lord rewards it anyway. Why? Because he's encouraging the jnanis and the yogis and the kamis, you know, want to take bhakti. Because my devotee is not even asking for it, and they're getting the results of all these things without, you know, a separate endeavor. So he's giving it to the devotees, they don't want it. But he's giving it to them, it encourages the jnanis and the yogis and the kamis like that. And out of his mercy, he wants his devotees not to have, there should not be anything lacking anyway. Right? So, yes, there is a general slow process, but by the grace of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, we just take the bhakti straight away. Yeah. And then, you know, jnana and vairagya are automatic features of practicing bhakti.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, you know, a devotee will gradually come to understand Sankhya and, you know, how to control the mind and senses attached to the will, which is what we're doing now.
Is that general slow process, is that the benefits accrued go to the soul, like the spiritual bank account, because in that such a long time, over many lifetimes, practically the living entity will go to, you know, lower planets and hellish conditions, and so do they still retain whatever spiritual advancement they make?
The element of bhakti awards the results of their activities, and you know, without bhakti, they're not awarded. You know, they're practicing their paths without bhakti will not produce a result. Bhakti at a certain level, you know, which may be you know, strongly mixed with the modes of material nature, or you know, maybe it's not considered of a pure level, it can produce liberation, it can produce the removal of karma, you know, liberation from different degrees of liberation. So if there's an element of bhakti there, they're performing activities and a lot of their karma is being removed, you know. So in other words, where they may perform some activities where they should, you know, be spending many hundreds more or thousands of lives more suffering in the material world, because there's an element of bhakti, it is actually capable of destroying a lot of karma, you know. So, you know, the different stages of liberation from misery and suffering. So that's certainly, you know, an effect which is very valuable, that's reaped over a long period of time. And, you know, it also, liberation means it awards them liberation from ignorance, which means that their consciousness does gradually elevate. That's one of the benefits of bhakti. It does allow a person's consciousness to... so sometimes people may go up and down to some degree or another, but their consciousness may have some element of knowledge that, you know, they may understand that they have taken... a bad birth, as a result of some sinful activity. So there's a good level of consciousness there as a result of bhakti. So that's a form of liberation in one sense, you know, to be not too much in ignorance. So, you know, the results of bhakti are there in many different ways, liberating them from ignorance, from suffering. But when it becomes more an element of bhakti proper, pure, then those spiritual assets tend to award them association with Vaishnavas, opportunities to, continue their pure devotional service and association with the, Srimad Bhagavatam. For people, to be able to read the Srimad Bhagavatam in any lifetime is the result of very special piety, of a devotional sort of a merit. It's not an ordinary thing to be able to read the Srimad Bhagavatam and to be able to roast that. It is so these are the permanent results of the given life after life, and reading the Bhagavad Gita, if someone is studying the Bhagavad Gita in the course of their lifetimes properly, and somehow or another their studies are very, very slow, they read a few slokas here and there, and then they're going about their calming sort of activities, and in the next life they actually get the opportunity to continue their studies of Bhagavad Gita from where they left off. There are different effects from bhakti according to the quality of bhakti, but you can say that they're permanent in different ways. Just bhakti, even performed improperly, will generally guarantee that a person at least doesn't become an animal. So they may be spent many, many lifetimes, in human form, somewhat going up and down, to some degree or another, but the fact that they're not going back into the animal species is like a permanent effect of bhakti as well. So a lot of different effects. Any questions or comments?
What's the effect of Kama Mishra Bhakti? Bhakti is mixed with the teach of material enjoyment. That's the destination.
I think they go to the heavenly planets.
But Bhakti is there, right? Component is in Bhakti.
Yeah, well, it depends. We'll discuss that. It's coming up. Okay. It's actually coming up when we look at devotional service and how it's mixed with the modes of material nature. So we'll look at that, the results of all the various types of bhaktis and the different types of bhaktis. It's a big subject. It was actually touched upon by Lord Kapila in the previous chapter. In the previous chapter, he discussed Raghunuga Bhakti. So, in verses 34 to 37, there are examples of, you see where it's talking about the deities, how the devotee relishes seeing the deities, and whatever. There are examples of, I think that was, where a person performs Vaidhi Bhakti, regulative devotional service, and they don't take up the Raghunuga or spontaneous form of bhakti, but having come to the level of bhava, automatically that Raghunuga develops. And those verses describe that level of devotees. At Bhava, the Raghunuga performance of devotional service. But they're Vaidhi Bhaktis, or devotees who never systematically practice Rabbin. And then in verse 38 it describes those who practice the Rabbin Yuga, even from not waiting for the platform of Bhava, but even from the platform of Nishtha, and they practice that Rabbin Yuga Bhakti. And then the next verses 39 and 40 describe devotional service without any tinge of Rabbin Yuga Bhakti. It's just Vaidhi Bhakti like that. So some of those things, have been touched upon, and they'll be expanded upon in later chapters, in which case we'll have a look at that in more detail. So the Prabhupada mentions in that purport, verse 1, that if one has even a slight desire to lord over material nature, there's no chance of it being freed from the influence of the nature's modes. So, with increasing degrees of bhakti, we actually get a decreasing desire to lord it over material nature. So one of the permanent effects of bhakti is that according to the level of bhakti you're performing, in the next life you start off with, a reduced level of desire to enjoy the material nature as a result of the level of bhakti you're on. That's another permanent effect. And as that bhakti increases, your desire to lord over material nature decreases proportionately. That's another permanent effect. You begin from where you left off. And and if we understand that we're the eternal servant of the Lord is actually, he is the enjoyer of the material energy. He's the Purush. That's the Sankhya is bringing us to this understanding. Who is the Purush, the living entity? We're trying to be the Purush, and then you study Sankhya and think, oh, actually, I'm not the enjoyer of the material nature. I'm suffering in the material nature. The super soul is enjoyed. Gradually, as that understanding becomes very, very fixed, and we practice, put it into practice, then we become free from the modes of material nature, more qualified to exist on a spiritual platform. Now verses 3 to 9 discuss this, the relationship between the Lord, the material nature, and the living entities. There's a phrase, Anadir Atma Purusho. It's a relevant, very relevant phrase for preaching purposes as a description of the Lord. Anadir Atma Purusho. Purush is, without beginning, and Purush, the person, the supreme person, Atma, the soul, the spiritual person, supreme spirit, he's beginningless. So, one, we understand he's a person, he's a supreme spirit. The supreme spirit is a person. That's how the Vedic literature describe the Supreme Spirit, Atma, is a person. Consciousness. Spirit means consciousness. And of course, he has super consciousness, that his consciousness is spread everywhere. It's there's a nice nice an analogy that a small light and the sunlight is perceived everywhere, even within the room and the sky, but a small light is experienced within a specific limit. So the Lord's consciousness is like that, like the sun, it spreads everywhere. It's a nice analogy. It is this consciousness, it's without beginning. And if it's without beginning, it's without end. Therefore, it's not material. Right? If you're discussing philosophy with someone and they accept that consciousness is something that has no beginning, then they also have to accept that that consciousness must be spiritual. Because it's a quality of material things that they have a beginning. So sometimes, you know, you're discussing philosophy with people and they contradict themselves. You know, because they don't know that actually in Kali Yuga no one knows any philosophy, actually. So, you know, that's what philosophy, they have to, you know, speak in a sentence, they have to read. Actually, they don't have philosophy, but you know, so they usually contradict themselves continually. But you know, consciousness is described in the scriptures as an adi, without beginning. Because without beginning means without end, and therefore it can't be material. And therefore, consciousness cannot be a product of the material elements of the body, which the scientists think. And they, therefore, if someone believes the consciousness is a product of the material body, that means they cannot also believe in the scriptures. But they can't accept the scriptures and say the consciousness, that, you know, because it's illogical. But this is good preaching. As Prabhupada sometimes says, the devil is quoting scripture.
So, Prabhu, this raises into relevance just to the Lord, or is it both the supreme consciousness as well as individual consciousness? So we've got to actually compare the two when we explain as how it's relevant for preaching.
Yes. It does. You know, anadi atma purusho. Now, of course, because the jiva has the same quality as the super soul, just not the same quantity, and that's the example of the small light. So yes, it can apply. An idea without beginning also means, you know, without a cause. An idea without beginning, you know, something has no beginning means there's nothing that could cause it. And therefore, that he is the cause. He is the cause of all causes. Now, another term there, Swayam Jyoti. He is like himself. These are terms, Swayam Jyoti. So, his light is distributed in different ways, as the Brahma Jyoti. It describes there that, we have experience in the material world. One light is a reflection of another. The moonlight reflects the sun, sunlight. The sunlight is a reflection of the Brahma Jyoti. The Brahma Jyoti is a spiritual effulgence, is a reflection of the body of the Supreme Lord. Now, Svamjyoti indicates that he is light himself, so he's self-luminous. Now, again, something that is self-illuminated again contradicts the theory that the soul, the spirit soul, or the spiritual consciousness develops at a certain point of material combination. Self-luminous means that it's not that it doesn't have any illumination, and then you combine some things and it becomes luminous. No, it is self-luminous by itself without any combination. So again, it is pointing to the fact that spiritual consciousness or the spiritual soul does not develop at a certain point of material combination. There's no tinge of anything material. Okay, so then we move on to verse 4. We've got to sort of tiptoe through all these verses because they take a lot of thought. And if you miss something, you know, along the way, then the next point becomes almost impossible to understand.
In Sanskrit, but do the individual residents of the Vaikuntha planets also have, they're not like the Lord, but are they also effulgent?
Yeah. Yes. They have the same quality. It's described in the Srila Prabhupada mentioned somewhere, the soul itself is more luminous than thousands of suns, or the sun, the soul itself. Now, in verse 4, as he's passed on, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the greatest of the great, accepted the subtle material energy which is invested with the three material modes of nature and which is related to Vishnu as his pastimes. Now, this is a very important verse as well, in that it does describe the nature of the Lord and how he creates the material world, but this this sort of statement, which is reflected in various Upanishads and Puranas, which the Mayavadis and the impersonalists seize upon as proof that the living entity or the Atma, the word being used here, comes to this material world as a pastime. There's an atheistic Sankhya, and you've probably got that in your books, I believe, which describes the difference between the comparison of Kapila Sankhya and atheistic Sankhya. We see that Kapila Sankhya, the cause of creation is the Supreme Lord's glance, whereas the atheistic Sankhya is that Prakriti or Praman produces the Purush and the Prakriti. Causes of suffering, according to the Kapila, is that the Jiva misidentifying with Prakriti, whereas the atheist saying that Prakriti, which is false. The concept of truth, the Jiva is the servant of Ishvara, the Jiva is the doer, and life comes from life. That's the actual truth. Whereas they say Jiva is Ishvara, Jiva is the controller, Prakriti is the doer, and that spirit comes from matter. And, where it refers to the process, the jiva surrenders to Ishvara, devotional service with knowledge of Sankhya and mystic yoga. That's the process. Whereas, their process is analyzing the elements, practicing mystic yoga, and separating the soul to get liberation. So there's some very distinct differences there. And, it's verses like this one, number four, by which they misconstrue a whole different meaning in order to literally use in the same verses sometimes of the Bhagavatam, or the philosophy, or the scriptures, to produce a completely different meaning. So we'll have a look at this. Now, this verse is, of course, saying that the Lord impregnated the Prakriti, or, the Pradhamba, the Jivas. And that's his pastime. That's how he accepted the material energy. That's how we understand it. We mention in chapter 5 of the second canto that when it says that the Lord accepts the three modes of material nature, it actually means that, his energy, Pradhan, accepts three qualities. In that way, it's his energy, so it's another way of saying he accepts three qualities. The Lord always remains Nirguna Brahman, without, the modes of material nature. And Saguna Brahman is where the three modes of material nature become, agitated. So, accepting the subtle material energy. He's accepting the material energy as the medium by which he will, purify, allow the conditioned souls, the jivas, to fulfill their material desires and ultimately become liberated from material existence. So he's accepting the material energy as, his energy, which is sometimes dormant, at other times he wakes up that material energy in one sense. So he's accepting the service of his material energy to do that. Not that he's accepting material qualities. That's how it can be misconstrued. As a pastime, the impersonalist is saying, yes, I'm also accepting material qualities for my pastime. But they are, covered by the material energy. The Lord accepts the material energy to carry out a function, but he always remains without any material qualities. The impersonalists think, I'm also having a pastime. I'm accepting the material energy for my pastime. But they become completely materially conditioned and controlled. That's the difference.
I didn't understand.
the impersonalists say that is stated in the scripture that the Lord, as a pastime, accepts the material energy and performs activities. So the impersonalists say, yes, we are that Lord, and we are accepting the material energy as our pastime. The difference is that when the impersonalists accept the material energy, they're not accepting it as, I can take it or leave it. They're actually forced to take birth. It's not like, pastime means maybe I will, maybe I won't. It's up to my pleasure. The impersonalists, they're forced to take birth. And for their philosophy, even a whole, is the Ishvara performing pastimes. But that hog is forced to take birth desire. It's not a pastime. So, you know, there's a difference between someone who's forced to accept material energy and to be punished and suffer, and the Supreme Lord who accepts the material energy for his purposes, never takes on any material, and always remains fully the control of the material energy for his pleasure, and never accepts any material qualities himself.
What do you mean by the Lord accepting the material energy?
He glanced upon the material energy, and he's performing activities in relationship to the material energy. But the activities that he's performing in relationship to the material energy is literally impregnating. So in other words, you know, the impersonal is saying, yes, we are also having sex. You know, the Lord is, you know, the Lord impregnates the living entities into the material world. The impersonalist will literally equalize their sex life, enjoying the material energy as the Purush, as something, you know, the same as the Lord being the Purush of the material energy. And therefore their imitation of the pastimes of Radha Krishna are on that level. So you see what I mean? So he's the Purush enjoying the material energy. And they say, yes, we are also the Purush enjoying the material energy. Just see how we enjoy. I will be Krishna, you will be Radha, let us have, you know, this, etc. So they take these things as being equal. And, you know, that this is the meaning of the Shastras.
And is it also that when the Lord comes down the earth, and so he is accepting the material energy to be able to pass that?
Well, sometimes, yes, he comes into the material world in his incarnation.
He's accepting the material world to pass
to perform his, to not only to impregnate the living entities, but also he comes in and, you know, we see that, you know, as Parashuram, he kills so many people, and as Lord Ramchandra, he rules a kingdom, and you know, so they think, yes, he is the Purush enjoying the pastime of being a king. You know, I want to enjoy as being a king. That's not what Lord Ram is doing. You know, Lord Ram is showing religious principles, and demonstrating, of course, that the you know, his devotee, who is taking shelter of him, is always, you know, never overcome by the demon of lust. That, you know, that's the purport of Ram's pastime. So they're equating the Lord's pastimes and the Lord's, you know, Vishnu Purusha avatar pastimes. They're saying that, yes, we are also accepting the material energy for our pastimes. You know, what I am doing, you know, Ram did this and I am doing that. Some of them actually say, I am greater than Ram. You know, some of the impersonalists have said like that. Krishna did this, Ram did this, I am greater, I have done this. Some say like that. That Krishna accepted, you know, as the Ishwara accepted the material energy for his pastimes, he did this, Ram did this, and I'm accepting like this and I'm doing like this. The difference is that they are forced to take birth and forced to suffer. We gave the example the other day of Mahabhava. So his philosophy, he is God, and you know, his philosophy is, don't worry, be happy, right? This is all a pastime, this is all a leela, right? Just love me, I am God. And then, you know, sometime later he was killed in a horrible car accident. So don't worry, be happy, let us all die in, you know, terrible tragic circumstances. This is my pastime. You know, my limbs are being ripped apart by this sharp metal, you know, ripping into my intestines. That's a, don't worry, we have this all just a pastime. I've planned this whole thing. It is. And next life, because I've been such a rascal, I'm going to take birth as a pig, you know, or a worm in stool. Don't worry, be happy. I'm now eating stool. This is all my pastime.
So, same thing, like, I'm not around you, I'm not around you, but
yes, they twist these things.
Are these impersonals, like, these are pretty heavy impersonals, are they mainly concentrated in India and impersonals in the West?
Most of them are concentrated in big lumps of stool at the moment. a big concentration of them. You see their ultimate destination. And they all gather together for their sanghas. So stool is everywhere.
Seems like in places in the West they're just trying to tail in the taste, they're just like, oh yeah, everything's one. Not so many of the planes.
It's surprising how everything comes from, just like the sun rises in the east, we say that the sun rises in the east, you know. You'll find that most philosophies you'll find in the world have emanated from India or something. You know, even the atheistic philosophies have emanated from, you know, a very celebrated person somewhere within India. So they're sort of, you know, imitations. And if you look at, you know, a lot of the, you know, so-called philosophers and what have you, at some stage in their life they've had some association, you know, either going to India or, you know, something like that, or they've read some books and that sort of sparked off the beginnings of their philosophy. Some of the things they most know.
It's like you, I think Prabhupada once said if you eat through the mouth or through the rectum, it's the same thing. That's the
Mayavadi philosophy. They can't make proper distinctions between things. They can't appreciate spiritual or material variety. So here, you know, we have to understand there's a distinction between the Lord accepting something as a pastime. A lot of nice analogies that Prabhupada gives, the difference between him in contact with material energy and the jiva in contact with material energy, that is not a pastime because they're forced. So it can't be a pastime. As soon as you're forced to do something, it can't be a pastime. And if there's suffering and ignorance, then, you know, it cannot be a pastime. That means the person is actually bewildered. Because even when the Lord appears, he never ever becomes bewildered. And even the Shaktivesh avatars, so for instance, you know, Shaktivesh avatars will appear in the world and they may take on an identity which is not their eternal swarup or identity, but the difference is that they never lose sight of their eternal identity. They remain fixed in their swarup, even though they may sometimes assume a different role as a Shaktivesh avatar. You know, therefore we see our acharyas that, you know, they have, you know, like Rupa Goswami, there's the understanding that in the spiritual world he is Rupa Manjari, and, you know, so their swarup is maintained. Although for the Lord's purposes, you know, the Lord may sometimes, in order to, you know, demonstrate certain aspects of that they're advancing or progressing or what have you for the pastime, so that we can learn how to progress and advance. Mm-hmm. He, by his spiritual energy, he sometimes covers them in the same way Arjun was covered. You know, Arjun, in essence, is always fixed in the understanding that he's the eternal associate of the Supreme Lord. You know, but that can be, that the Lord can temporarily cover that, not by material ignorance, but by the yoga maya, in order to facilitate a pastime. So, but the impersonalists, their eternal identity is completely covered. So much so that they're thinking they're God. Because So, it's not that the sun actually covered by a cloud. Only the vision of the ordinary being is covered. Similarly, Maya cannot cover the Supreme Lord, who is beyond Maya. The material energy covers the ordinary living entities. Very nice analogy. Now, why is this material world created? Looking at verse 5, there's hint to that in the previous word for the Lilaya, for the Lord's pastimes. What is that pastime? He wants to rectify the enduring temperament of the conditioned souls. He's not actually taking the position of the enjoyer of the material energy in one sense, although it's under his control. And performing activities for his pleasure. He's not trying to exploit the material energy as an impersonalist do. He wants to, it's an act of compassion and love for the living entities.
Sorry, Prabhu.
Sorry, I might have to go back on the earlier topic. When you mentioned that Lord covers by yoga maya as a pastime, does he do it just to the Shakti Vesha avatars, or even to, he could do it to anybody?
He does it to himself in order to facilitate the pastime. Yoga Maya acts to cause some forgetfulness. For instance, in the case of Mother Yashoda, Krishna shows her that he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead and then causes her to forget that. Because he doesn't want to disturb her mood as a mother. But that doesn't mean that at any stage she's, some illusion or material. She's always fixed in her sarup that I'm the servant of Krishna. In her eternal rasa as a mother. Arjuna was like that with Krishna. When he's covered, he doesn't leave the platform that he's Krishna's eternal friend. So, Prabhupada gives another nice analogy, is there's no necessity for government to create a separate police department, but there's no doubt that some citizens are not going to follow the law, so some department is necessary. There's no necessity to create a material world for the sufferings of the conditioned souls, but at the same time, some of them are nityabhata, they're eternally conditioned. It's an optional activity that the Lord is not forced to do, and yet It's necessary for the conditioned souls. Nityabhadda, when we say Nityabhadda, of course we mean that we can't trace out the history of when they become rebellious against the Supreme Lord. So that's Nitya, that's the Nitya part. There's no trace out. Bhadda means that they're covered. You know, tree covered, red, white and blue by various modes of material nature. So there's two aspects to that. We say, what does Nityabhadda mean? Nitya means that we can't trace out practically eternally when they become rebellious. Bhadda means that they're conditioned by three modes of material nature. So, you know, verses 7 and 8 also take up this aspect of the Mayavadi philosophy of, conditional existence is their lila or pastime. So as we've been describing there, the word pastime implies enjoyment in the activities of the Lord. You know, the Mayavadis use the word and say that even the living entity has become a stool-eating hog. He is also enjoying his pastimes. This is a most dangerous interpretation. In the conditioned life, the living entity actually remains as if a captive in the hands of the material energy. He is simply, and the Lord, he is simply the witness of the action. Oh, sorry, the living entity is the witness of the action, but he is forced to act in that way due to his offence in his eternal relationship. The Lord comes by his own energy, his own spiritual energy, Atmamaya, is not forced by any superior energy. So that's a pastime. These verses clearly state, in the Vedic literatures, in every instance, clearly state that the living entity is forced to accept a material body. It's forced by the material energy to accept it. So that cannot be a pastime. According to his karma. So this is, again, so-called philosophers contradict themselves because, they will talk as if this is my karma and, I'm enjoying my karma, this is my pastime to enjoy my karma in this way. But if you use the term karma, it's not a pastime because karma means you're forced to accept the reaction.
Even if they're suffering.
What's that?
Even if they're suffering. I suppose they
don't
think they have lost
money
or whatever.
Even if
they think that
they have
insurance.
Oh, yes.
All
I was talking to my elder daughters one time. They were about they're about 13 or something, and we're on our way to Gopal's, and I was going to the farm to Gopal's, and I mentioned to them, there's some people actually believe they're God, and they said, no, that's they found it very hard to believe. I said, yes, it's strange but true. When we got to Gopal's, we sat, and there was a young couple, a boy and a girl, and I asked them, we were having lunch with them, and I asked them what they did, and said, we do yoga. And I said, is there a philosophy behind that? And they said, yes, we understand that we're God, and this is our pastime, and, my girls just turned around and just looked at me like, it's true, Dad, it's true, And I tried very hard to convince them, that there's no possible way that you can be God. And no matter what I said, they would not accept it. They were condemned, and they had every argument in the book. These were about 18 and 19 and 20. They had every argument in the book. They were convinced philosophically that they were God, and this is all their past.
Were they from India?
No, they're just Westerners practicing yoga and learning all this Mayavadi philosophy. The Mayavadi philosopher's presentation is the living entity enjoys his pastime by accepting the body of a whole. You know, pastime means voluntary acceptance of enjoyment, for enjoyment. You know, even if someone says, yes, I voluntarily accept this position, I'm suffering, but it's my past. No. Pastime means voluntary acceptance for enjoyment. You know, it's like you say to the prisoner, ah, yes, this is, you know, I'm in prison. You know, this is my pastime. Was that the prasad? Did you want prasad for 20 people? Call me back. When there is enforced acceptance for suffering, it is not a pastime. So you see, you know, people in prison. They may actually think like that. You know, this is my pastime, I'm suffering. And, you know, you see these impersonalists, even, you know, they suffer greatly, even within the course of their lifetime. You know, some of them get cancer, you know, because they all get old and they die. But, you know, they claim all along, this is all my pastime.
Then that can be confusing, then
when
devotees also have problems like cancer.
I mean, they're not saying it's their pastime if they suffer.
No, they're not saying it, but if you want to explain, you say, okay, even great devotees are suffering, so what? Even we are suffering. So that becomes an argument for them.
No, because if you ask that devotee why you're suffering, he will say, it's because I have no love for God. I'm suffering the reactions of my past simple activities, and you know, the Lord is so kind and is reducing this, but this is the devotee would, you know, if someone asks them, the devotee, they will say, this is not my pastime, this is, you know,
that is true. But I'm saying, when we want to talk to such people, they are all the more convinced that okay, because they say that the devotee is even saying
that
they are suffering, they are also suffering, it's okay.
Yes, but the devotee
is not saying he's God. I understand that. Yeah. They are not saying that. But for them, it becomes a positive point. For the people who are impersonal, it becomes a positive point. It becomes a positive point. It's okay, you can't tell them, okay, the devotees are not saying that. Mm. I understand that.
Yes, they're stubborn. They're dogs, obstinacy is probably called.
But if devotees can also have, you can say that, okay, you're suffering so much, how do you say that you are God? But they say that, oh, the devotees and even Krishna suffer. They say even Krishna suffer. So, yeah, well,
there's no evidence that Krishna suffered.
No, they're saying that, for example, seemingly
that
in the battlefield, Krishna, they interpret it in any way. Yes. Krishna has to be away from Radharani.
They can interpret it any way, but if we take what the scriptures describe, we see that actually Krishna doesn't suffer. You know, that Krishna acted beyond, you know, therefore, you know, we see that even when he was, you know, apparently been on the planet for over 128 years, he still appeared like a fresh youth. You know, he had, you know, so many millions
to spend. His own dynasty had all the kings and all that. Krishna sitting all alone.
Yes.
I for another person, it may seem as if Krishna is suffering.
Yes.
It's again material consciousness, isn't it?
It may appear like that, therefore we have to study the teachings of Lord Kapila in order to see the difference. So, yeah, they may see like that, so therefore we study scripture in order to understand the reality. So for instance, you know, you can look at anything and, you know, give some interpretation what you're experiencing, but then you know if you want to study the truth of the matter, then we have to look more carefully and study what is the truth of it. So if we're studying the science of God, the Supreme Lord, the living entity, the spirit soul, the supreme spirit, the material elements, time, the super soul, karma. If we're studying those things, we can't expect that, 15 minutes a day yoga practice, performing all sorts of simple activities, engaging in, you know, illicit sex, reading armchair philosophy with a few buddies is going to actually allow us to enter into those deep mysteries, you know.
So
therefore they would have to accept that it may appear like that, but if you want to understand, so let us discuss philosophy. Let us, you know, if we want to understand some, you know, just like science, you know, if someone said, someone says, a doctor says, you know, if you take such and such a magnesium, you know, you won't get cramps in your legs or something. And someone says, oh, you know, it appears that it's not the magnesium that you're taking, but the water you're drinking is stopping the cramps. When you take the magnesium, you're having it with a glass of water. And they'll say, oh, it's the water, not the magnesium. So then the doctor will have to explain to them, well, you know, it may appear like that, but if you want to study medicine, you have to, you know, study for many, many years the anatomy of the body and how the chemical, you know, you can't make a statement like that, an unqualified statement, and expect that any sane man is going to accept it if you've not studied. In other words, if you discuss with medical people who have studied all their lives, and you know, as opposed to someone who's just picked up a Reader's Digest and read an article about magnesium in water, no one will accept that. In the same way, you know, people can make statements about spiritual subject matters, but if they have a very casual approach to spiritual life, no sane, respectable person will accept such a statement. So therefore they would have to make a more serious study of it in order for people to accept their philosophy. So let us sit down and discuss it more seriously and see if you know, it's what they're saying stacks up. We're quite willing to debate the issue for 20, 30 years. We can discuss it for as many, but they only want to think about it for 5 minutes and make a few statements and then go off and enjoy sense gratification as a result of their, you know, newfound philosophy. So, you know, you don't even have to discuss much philosophy with such persons. You really just have to look at their approach to spiritual life to be able to discredit the whole, you know, what they're saying.
Why don't you just have to look at
them? Well, you know, for instance, if someone is a medical, sometimes people get involved in medicine, and it's obvious to those in the profession that that person, you know, has just a very casual understanding of medicine. Then you don't have to necessarily discuss medicine with them in order to treat them. You just have to point out how casual their approach is to the subject. you know, what are their qualifications? See? In the same way, people may say anything about spiritual topics, but then, you know, you say, well, what are your qualifications to say that? So these things are, you know, it's a fact that these things can be quite difficult. Therefore, you will see that if you speak to the majority of people in this world about spiritual topics, most of them have a misunderstanding. They don't know. They don't. You know, the majority. One of the things that we try to, you know, Srila Prabhupada always stressed the point that, you know, in essence, you're saying, you know, I want to see God. You know, I don't think Krishna is God. I want, you know, I'm looking for God, or, you know, I think so-and-so is God. But what is your qualification to see God? You know, what makes you so qualified that you can discuss the issue of God? What did you ask him? What is your qualification? You know, and you know, within a few minutes you'll see there's no qualification. So then if there's no qualification, why are they making statements? You know, they cannot make statements on law, they cannot make statements on medicine, they cannot make statements on any science, you know, physics. If someone's unqualified, you say, you know, you could actually say to the person, you're discussing one of the greatest sciences in this world, you seem very intelligent. You know, tell me something about, you know, what you know about quantum physics. Because obviously, you know, any unqualified person can discuss any science. This is your position. Tell me something about... you know, this or that or the other, and then immediately they'll say, oh, well, I don't know anything. And then you say, in the same way, you have the same qualification as spiritual life, you shouldn't be making statements. So that's why, you know, Sankhya means a very analytical, scientific, thorough discussion of all the elements involved. So we can ask them, you know, you're making a statement about spiritual life. What is the difference between matter and spirit? What are the different varieties of spiritual consciousness? What are the different varieties of the material elements? How does time affect those material elements? You know, how do they combine? Is it through the material energy, the spiritual energy? If you can answer those questions for me, then I will accept your view on, you know, spiritual matters. But if you can't answer any of those questions, then I'd have to question that if you can't understand the elements of matter and spirit, how can you discuss, you know, very elevated topics on the science of God? So therefore, you know, we're discussing Sankhya. You know? See, you know, quite often you don't even have to go too far. A lot of times when people start going off in their philosophy, I usually ask them one question, which puts them in their place pretty quick. I just say, what's the difference between matter and spirit? One question, and they're like, well, spirit is, they have no definition, and that's it. And then you say, oh, you don't know the definition of the matter and spirit, and you're telling me all these things about spiritual life, and they usually, you see, they just stop. That's it. They understand, or, you know, I don't understand the beginning. I can't answer the first question, and I'm sitting here telling him so much about spiritual life.
They say,
I'm
a spirit because
every day
I'm consuming spirit.
But what is spirit?
What is spirit? Yeah, sure. I'm a spirit. Spirit
is excited. Yeah. Feed you some food, you don't know what you're eating. What you do,
You have some degree of intelligence to speak, isn't it?
Yes.
But if people are foolish, okay, that's another point. Foolish people, basically, like talking to animals, you know, it's worth not saying.
Keep giving them prasad, and talk less and listen more. That's one of the good things about giving people prasad, is they talk less and listen more because they're eating.
Yeah. Otherwise, you can't even talk to them.
That's very interesting.
grants people these transmissions.
You know, so therefore, you see, if devotees have a good understanding of Sankhya, then even asking one or two questions reveals their lack of qualification. And then if you very easily answer that and progressively point out, you know, quite like we were discussing before, something is self, you know, illuminating, it can't have, you know, or it's beginningless, and these are the, you know, because quite often these people will accept some scriptural statements, so yes, they'll accept, yes, spirit is, you know, beginningless and what have you, but they will still equate it with the atheistic Sankhya philosophy that spirit is the product of matter. So therefore, they've contradicted themselves. So then you just point that out. You know. So if we actually have a proper understanding of Sankhya philosophy, it makes the devotee themselves very secure in their realizations about why, you know, that yes, you know, there's a difference between me and God, and I am the servant of God, and that will, and I am different from matter, and that process of bhakti will disentangle me from matter. They have very analytical, proper understanding. And they can also defend themselves from all sorts of, you know, philosophies, and not only defend themselves, but they can actually convince other people, you know, very scientifically. Anyone, you know, if you understand this Sankhya philosophy, actually you have the ability to approach any person in this world, whether they be, a Nobel Prize winning, you know, physicist. You know, an astronaut going to the moon. You know, a teacher of quantum mathematics. You know, a bricklayer. Whatever. You know, if you understand this philosophy, because that was Prabhupada's stance. The Prabhupada, you know, would challenge any person, no matter what their qualification. And he did it just on the basis of a solid understanding of Srimad Bhagavatam. And no one could even get near him to defeat anything. They could never defeat even one thing Prabhupada said. And Prabhupada, you know, would defeat everything that they said, resounding, smashed into pieces like that. So, you know, this is the benefit of, you know, a proper understanding of this. Not just that you'd be popular when you give Srimad Bhagavatam classes. So what is the difference between matter and spirit? That's what we're looking at here. Now, can you just turn that light on? So actually, you know, the Mayavadi philosophers, now Devahuti is asking, you know, she's asking more questions about how the material nature works under the direction of the Lord and the relationship between the material nature and the Lord. So she wants to ask further questions because, you know, in other words, Prabhupada points out in verse 9 that she wants to know the characteristics of the Supreme Lord. When it is said that the living entities are bewildered, the Mayavadi philosophers ascribe this bewilderment to the Supreme Lord. You know, that it's his lila, that he's become bewildered. But Devahuti wants to know how he's dealing with the material nature, because when you understand that, you understand that he's not bewildered. So she's asking that. She's very intelligent. So some very simple points that Prabhupada, in his analogy, is that Prakriti is connected with both the Supreme and the living entities, just as a woman is connected with her husband as a wife and her children as a mother. These analogies are actually very, very powerful. You know, they have so many applications. It's a simple analogy, but if you see Prabhupada use them, they're like weapons. They can just tear down, and as we said, you know, people attack Krishna consciousness from so many angles of vision with all sorts of scientific jargon and what have you, and these simple analogies here just rip them to pieces. They're very powerful when properly used. You know, something that's... if you know how to use something, it becomes very powerful. Even though to others, it may look, insignificant. I had a friend of my father's used to come to our house, and he would teach us things like karate and what have you. He used to teach us how to you could use anything as a weapon. And every time he would come, he would open up the boot of his car, and he would pull out all these different things, and he would show us, you know, he had axes and this and that. Yeah. So he once showed us how he could, if you gave him a palm full of 20-cent pieces, he could practically kill you. He was like a marine, he would aim them for your temple and he could kill you in about 2 minutes with a handful of 20-cent pieces. So, you know, these little analogies, they're like our 20-cent pieces. We can destroy these powerful Mayavada philosophers. Alright, now, let's have a look at a brief view of, overview of creation, verses 10 to 61. Explain the difference between the Pradhan and the Prakriti. Alright, so now, so 10 to 61. Pradhan and Prakriti. Who wants to give a definition of Pradhan and Prakriti? Who would like to? What have you studied?
Pradhan?
Pradhan and Prakriti. What is the difference between Pradhan and Prakriti? You know,
Pradhan is when the three modes of material nature are in neutrality, because they are not even one of the modes or material elements is active. It is in a neutral state. So the actual creation hasn't happened. And the time element is not present in Pradhan. So when the time element gets manifested, activated, then Pradhan can be turned into the Prakriti, where there is some existence of different elements and the modes are active, certainly.
So I will put in a different short way,
That's good.
Pradhan could be a subtle aspect, and Prakriti is a gross aspect.
And Prakriti is still very subtle. But the Prabhupada says,
it's very manifest.
Yeah, it manifests
with the time and three modes of material nature. But he says that Pradhan is a subtle aspect. Material nature is a subtle aspect.
Pradhan is the subtle, undifferentiated sum total of all material elements. So undifferentiated, they're not manifest, very subtle. Prabhupada mentions when the total material elements are manifested by the interaction of the three modes, the manifestation is called Prakriti.
So this is before Mahatattva, like this?
Yes. So, in its original condition, Prakriti is somewhat invisible as well. It's very subtle.
Is Prakriti...
The variety is there. There's a variety, but it's still, in the initial state of Prakriti, the gunas are still in balance. So, in Prabhupada's, he makes a distinction, right? Pradhana is a subtle, undifferentiated sum total of the material elements. Now, when the material elements are manifested by the three modes of material nature, it's called Prakriti. But, you know, manifested is still in a very subtle state. Because, you know, Prakriti is before Mahatattva. Mahatattva manifests. What's that? The Mahatattva is manifested, you know, from the Prakriti. And the Mahatattva, you know, manifests the different elements. And even then, it's in a very subtle state. It's a little bit more manifest.
So, what is the Lord agitates? The Pradhan that he agitates?
Yeah, Pradhan.
And then it becomes the more interact. That's Prakriti.
And then, you know, as Gopi Brindesh is saying, that, you know, when that agitation is there, the Pradhan, you know, Prabhupada says, the condition of material nature immediately previous to its manifestation is called Pradhan. And, you know, he's saying when the total material elements are manifested by the interaction of the three modes of material nature, the manifestation is called Prakriti. Now, we still have to understand that at that stage, you know, the manifestation of material elements is very subtle. You know, they're certainly more subtle than, you know, at the stage of the Mahatattva.
I think the Mahatattva, still you have this 34 material elements, right, including senses, you know, working senses. So it's a little bit of a gross, isn't it? Working senses.
Yeah, you know, the 24 elements, you know, at first they're totally undifferentiated, then they become differentiated, but they're still very subtle. And gradually, you know, from something becomes from something more subtle to a more gross manifestation. You know, in one sense, it's sort of like, you know, if you have, you know, a cloud form. That you know, there's water vapor in the air, so subtle you can't. There's no cloud. So then, you know, it condenses gradually. You know, some misty sort of mistiness to the sky. It's almost still not a cloud, but it's a little bit more visible. Gradually it becomes more like a cloud, and then it produces rain and lightning and thunder. And it's like, you know, increasing degrees of subtleness until the gross manifestation. So Prakriti is still quite subtle. Although, you know, in the long run, when it becomes fully manifest, because the sum total is Prakriti that is manifested, it also has a gross manifestation in the long run. We can, so, you know, the universe is now manifest, so, you know, what is that universe? It's a Prakriti. We're looking at the manifestation of Prakriti. But initially, Prakriti is still in somewhat a very subtle state, and it's still called Prakriti.
So, at what stage it becomes, it turns from gross to subtle?
Well, we'll go through that. You know, Vishwanath Chakravarti, the course, says Prakriti is called avyakta, unmanifest, though having variety. It has a state of invisibility when the three gunas are in balance. It is called pradhan because manifesting variety, it is the best. In the shadow of all the visible elements, it is called Prakriti because it is the very cause of all causes and effects. So, you know, in Vishvanatha Chakrabarti Thakura's description of Prakriti and Pradhan, there is, in the initial stages, there is a distinction, but it is so in one sense, you know, Prakriti has almost, you know, Prakriti and Pradhan practically have the same qualities, you know, in their initial stage.
Prakriti,
there
is no living,
soul
is not present.
No.
But the Prakriti has the living entity?
Prakriti manifests because the living entities have been impregnated into the Pradhan. So yes. You know, another way that this is looked at is that, you know, we will look at the 24 elements, material elements, and then there are four other ingredients. The jiva. So once the Pradhan has been agitated by time, actually 28. There's the 24 material elements, there's the jiva, time, paramatma, and Prakriti. So Prakriti is almost like an element that is manifest from the, you know.
Okay, so Prakriti is that
28th
element. Somewhere,
Mahatattva
is somewhere considered as an element, or?
Yes, sometimes Mahatattva.
The Supreme Lord impregnates the entities into Prakriti.
And in that case, you see that at some stages, prior to the manifestation of the Mahatattva, there's almost Prakriti and Mahatattva, almost indistinguishable. So, therefore, they can. Sometimes you can say Prakriti is the 28th and Mahatattva, and at the very initial stage, you know, practically, although certainly Pradhan has been agitated and the Prakriti becomes manifest, but you know, their qualities are very, very subtle. We say, you know, yes, the 24 qualities become manifest, but they're still in such a subtle state, not necessarily, you know, that they're all the 24 elements are there, you know, in their gross form. It's not that, they're in a very subtle form.
And again, Mahatattva goes through the three stages.
Yes.
You know, with the Pradhan, you know, Pradhan
is you're in a cloud, you're lost in the mist of the Mahatattva.
So, Pradhan is agitated with time, and the three modes of material nature, you get Prakriti, then it becomes 25. Now, at what stage you get 28 then? How does it go from 25 to 28?
Yeah, well, you have the time, the jiva.
Time is equal to no Prabhu, then it becomes 25.
Well, the jiva is 26.
What stages are they added in?
We'll see at the end of this chapter that the super soul eventually enters within and amalgamates them all. So, you know, time, it appears at time, the living entities.
Three more self-karma.
Time, the living entities. Well, you know, time, Prakriti, time, the jiva is Prakriti, basically, and then the super soul. Because Prakriti is not there before the time, the jiva is the time, the jiva is Prakriti, and then, you know, the Prakriti gradually manifests the 24 elements, which are all combined by the super soul. Enters within.
Once he combines the super
soul, that, you know, that's the super soul as Chiradakshaya Vishnu, but in essence, you know, Mahavishnu you know, is there from the very beginning, you know, as the super soul of the entire material creation. But in one sense, the super soul within each universe, you know, that's so the super soul is there from the very beginning in one sense, and then to amalgamate all the elements within the universe, then he is expanded, Shirat Akshay, super soul, you know, comes in later to amalgamate.
Is it all those elements that Brahma uses?
Yes.
But the Lord basically impregnates the prakriti essence with the living entities. What do you imagine?
Yeah. Yeah, the pradhan.
Pradhan.
But sometimes you see that Prabhupada says that you know, the Lord impregnates the degree, and sometimes Prabhupada says that the Lord impregnates the mahatat.
He says material nature, so that's what he impregnates material nature. What's material nature? Is it property or?
Yeah, well, you know, it depends how you describe creation, because you know you can describe creation, because sometimes the whole material energy is wound up. If the whole material energy is wound up, it means the Mahatattva is wound up, and the Kriti and even Pradhan, you know, become, although they're, you know, eternal energies, they're dormant within the Lord. But sometimes you know, everything is wound up within the Mahatattva. The universes can be wound up and then released again into the Mahatattva. So there are different levels of winding up material energy, in which case, well, if material energy is not fully wound up, then it's not wrong to say that the living entities may be, you know, in other words, the Lord breathes in. So at the very beginning, the Lord actually, you know, wakes up the sleeping material energy, but, you know, once doing that, the universes are expanded into the Mahatattva, and then with his breath, they are, you know, everything is wound up, you know, the universes are wound up into the Mahatattva, everything is wound up. But then as he breathes out, they return to the Mahatattva. So, you know, there appears to be different stages of winding up the material energy. So, you know, in one sense, it's not wrong to say that, you know, so that the living entities appear along, you know, along with the universe, you know, into the Mahatattva. So, you know, see what I mean? So if you haven't wound everything up fully, then, you know, at one stage you say the living entities are impregnated within the Mahatattva, but if you go to the very beginning, you might say that they're impregnated within the Pradhan. And then, you know, if the Lord has already agitated the, the Pradhan with the time elements at the very beginning of creation, that means if time is there, then the Lord may, you know, and the living entities are being wound up and then re-impregnated, that means they're going into the Prakriti because time is already there. So, you know, it's not wrong to say these things, but it's in one sense it's pointing to different stages of where the living entities are going into the material energy from the very beginning, or when it's been, you know, the universes are coming in and out, or according to how things are wound up. Alright, now verse 10 and 11. The aggregate elements, namely the five gross elements, the five subtle elements, the four internal senses, the five senses for gathering knowledge, and the five outward organs of action are known as the pradana. And there, Srila Prabhupada does mention the, you know, the sum total of the 24 elements described in herein is called the Yoni Mahatbrahma. So verses 12 and 13, you know, describe the five gross elements and five subtle elements, the knowledge acquiring organs. They're all mentioned in your student handbook on page 87. So we won't go into any great detail. We have covered them. So there's other things more pressing in this class that we need to go through. Verse 14, the internal subtle senses are experiences having four aspects in the shape of mind, intelligence, ego and contaminated consciousness. This is probably something we'll look at a little bit more closely. Citta. Distinctions between them can be made only by different functions since they represent different characteristics. Now all of these are considered the qualified Brahman. The mixing element, which is known as time, is counted as the 25th element. Saguna Brahman. The time factor. That is one of the ways the Lord, that is the way that the Lord speaks to every conditioned soul. That's time. Time agitates the neutral, unmanifested nature. Consciousness, of course, is the spirit, and mind is function, as it describes here, that distinctions between them can only be made by different functions since they represent different characteristics. So, on the spiritual platform, these things are all there, you know, in other words, the soul, all of these functions are carried out by the conscious soul. Spirit of soul. In the material world, everything is carried out by mechanical means. So, you know, for the soul, there's no real distinction between its consciousness and its senses. You know, the conscious being the senses. All of the senses of the soul are fully conscious and literally composed of consciousness. But, you know, in the material world, all our functions are carried out by a mechanical device, you know, either subtle or gross. So each of the different functions, which are all, you know, advayagyan or, you know, absolute in the spiritual world, but each function actually in the material world has to be done with a separate mechanical, you know, way. So, you know, for accepting and rejecting the mind. So we'll look at those, you know, the mind and the intelligence and the ego and citta. They all, you know, different functions being carried out of different aspects of consciousness that functions that are there in the material world, which in the spiritual world are not done so much with the separate mechanical devices, but you know, non-different from, you know, the very intrinsic composition of the soul. So, but we're going to come to that. So, just anyway, you know, keep in mind, at this stage, there's a very you know, whether we're talking about Vikriti or Pradhan, for our purposes, you know, we're sort of referring to Vikriti, you know, once it's been agitated by the time factor. Once Pradhan has been agitated by the time factor, in essence, we're, you know, calling it Vikriti. In another sense, know, there is, say, you know, sometimes the acharyas just call Pradhan Vikriti. They call it Pradhan because it's the most, you know, as described by Vishwanath Chakravarti, they call it, you know, the very terms, you know, we call it. It's the best or the prime, you know, something which is the prime thing or the best is Pradhan. Prakriti, you know, has a suggestion of the cause of cause and effects. So, in one sense, you know, you can call the you can call it Pradhan, Brahman. You know, so that's another name. You know, it's called Mahabrahma. So it's not wrong to say that, you know, when we're talking about Pradhan, we're talking about Brahman. But it's the same substance. You can give it different names according to certain qualities that it has. So, you know, it's not, you know, you can interchange the terms Prakriti and Pradhan, in other words, according to the qualities you're discussing about it, when it's in that most subtle, you know, essential stage. You know, there's some distinction there, but it's, you know, in one sense, when you're talking about it just a little bit more generally, you can interchange some of the terms. You know, you can call it Brahman, you know, Mahat Brahman, whatever it is, the Kriti Pradhan, you know, and you still talk about the very same thing. But in another very technical sense, there is a slight, you're referring to that one thing in a slightly different way according to the name you're giving it. So sometimes you're saying Prakriti, it can be referring to Prakriti, in an essence you're actually talking about Pradhan. That's my point.
The word Brahman for Prakriti is a bit confusing, because normally we mean Brahman is a Brahman effulgence.
Yes.
The Brahma Jyoti. So here it is considered as a material aspect. When you say, Prakriti Brahman, but actually Brahman is the first realization of the Lord.
Yeah, well, you know, so from that we understand that the Lord's energy, he can use it to act materially or spiritually. But it's really the same thing, like electricity, you know, you can use it for heating or cooling, but it's the same energy. So, yeah. So he, you know, by the way he utilizes the energy, you know, he can create a material effect. Therefore, it's the same energy which is. But because he's invested that energy with three qualities to give it distinguishing factors, so you know he hasn't done that in the spiritual energy, but when he invests the Brahma with three qualities and then you know agitates those three qualities, it takes a material that's how we get the material effect. But it's actually the same. So the Saguna Brahman and Nirguna Brahman. Nirguna without the qualities and Saguna with the qualities. But then if you see, you know, what actually, how does Brahman get those qualities? You know, there is different Shaktis, you know, Jnana Shakti and Dravya Shakti and Kriya Shakti, which are basically investing in material energy with different qualities. So that his spiritual energy is acting there anyway, you know. So it's and those different, you know, his one spiritual energy has many different divisions. You know, we say primarily three, but there are many, many different divisions according to the function. Just like we're talking now consciousness, then you know what you do with your consciousness has different divisions, but it's so subtle, you know, what is the mind and the intelligence, you know, they're so subtle, but it's really the same thing being used in a different way, in one sense. And because that way is quite distinct and you know, purposeful, it's almost like a separate thing. So, you know, my point is that it is good to try and understand when Prabhupada uses the word, what is he referring to? If he's talking about Prakriti, generally what stage is he understanding? Sometimes you have to understand it from the context of that particular section of the Bhagavatam, because it may be used in a slightly different way somewhere else. When he's talking about Prakriti, he may be referring to Pradhan, as we're sort of know by another definition. That's the thing. Try and understand the definition, but they're very subtle and they are sometimes interchangeable to some degree. So, you know, don't get too technical on the terms, you know, that someone in class says, you know, he's talking about Pradhan, and you pull him, Prabhu, you know, we did Bhakti by Baba, and, you know, you're talking a whole lot of hogwash, and I'm not coming to your class. So, you know, just be a little aware, it's a very, very subtle time. Alright, so we are moving into the realms of consciousness. Now, verse 17. So the super soul is the Lord adjusts the different elements, keeping himself within as the super soul and without as time. There's 26 elements there. Then in verse 19, after the personality of Godhead impregnates material nature with his internal potency, that's the jivas, the living entities, material nature delivers the sum total of the cosmic intelligence, which is known as Varanmaya. This takes place in material nature when she is agitated by the destinations of the conditioned souls. So we have time, the Lord is there as the super soul, of course, you know, and the living entities impregnated within the material universe. So now we have Hiranmaya, you know, we have a whole lot of conscious living entities. So consciousness is, in effect, I mean, apart from the Lord's consciousness, but we have the consciousness of the living entities being impregnated with the material energy. So it is somewhat, this is what's described in the Bhagavad Gita, of course. That part of material nature which is called Pradhan as well as Brahman is impregnated by the Supreme Personality of God and delivers a variety of living entities. And when it says it delivers a variety of living entities, of course there is a succession of events by which it does that. Not like that. What's that?
Just trying to find out where it
was. Verse 19. So, yeah. So, what happens is, you know, it's at this stage, of course, that the because of the entrance of the jivas, of the mahatattva, will become manifest from the prakriti. You know, Hiranmaya means it has, you know, it's got this great brilliance, refulgence because of the consciousness of the living entities. Just in summary, so we know that what happens, of course, is that the Mahatattva becomes manifest with 16 material ingredients. You know, that's, you know, therefore we understand that, you know, the material ingredients which are manifest in the prakriti must be much more subtle because they, you know, become manifest. The gross material elements become manifest with the Mahatattva. Verse 20, thus after manifesting variegatedness, the effulgent Mahatattva, which contains all the universes within itself, which is the root of all cosmic manifestations and which is not destroyed at the time of annihilation, swallows the darkness that covered the effulgence at the time of dissolution.
In Mahatattva, other elements doesn't get manifested in due course of
time? Yeah, in the Mahatattva, the material elements. Yeah.
Or the 24?
Yes, all the 24.
Yeah.
Yeah, we say 16, but, you know, the principle is 16, and from that we understand the 24 of which you produce, yes. So, the Mahatattva, of course, is the seed of the universe in the sense that, you know, the universe becomes covered by the elements of the Mahatattva, and the elements of the Mahatattva actually also, manifest as the universal form within the universe. So they're the seed of the universe in the sense that, you know, it will expand, you know, just as a seed grows, you know. Seed grows, literally drawing from all the elements around it, you know, gradually amalgamates with the various elements around it, grows into a big tree. So, you know, it's a seed in that sense. It will just amalgamate with the various elements of the Mahatattva to grow into a universe like that. You know, in that sense, all the universes are there within the Mahatattva. Because, all the seeds of the universe are there, and because of the living entities there, it is somewhat called this consciousness. So now, the Mahatattva, as we know, will manifest in material elements starting with the Ahankara, which is very, very subtle, the false ego. Now, the Mahatattva is somewhat more fixed, unlike the mind. It's covered by darkness at the time of destruction, therefore the Mahatattva, in one sense, is merged with the Prakriti. So, you know, when everything is dark before the entrance of the living entities, Mahatattva in essence is there within the Prakriti. It's not something which is destroyed, it's there in a very subtle form, as in a very subtle manifestation within the Prakriti. That's why it says it's not destroyed at the time of annihilation. You know. It sort of enters within the Prakriti. And gradually with the illumination more gross manifestation, it becomes more manifest. But it's there. It's not that someone's added something, it's always there, you know, it's just in a more subtle form.
It's in a subtle form in Prakriti, so it's never destroyed.
No, that's right.
It's just unmanifest.
Prabhu, the universes are said to expand from the pores of Mahavishnu.
Yes.
So, Mahatattva is outside of Mahavishnu. Here it says, Mahatattva is the seed of the universe.
Yes.
Because
the seed of the universe, because all the elements are there, and of course, all the elements of that expand the universe are there. You know, when we talk about the universe, we talk about there are the seven layers, and then, you know, the ingredients within by which the universe expands within the covering is, you know, that all expands, it all sort of grows in one sense. After the Mahatattva is manifest, Lord, from his poreholes, the universes enter within the Mahatattva and become covered. That's described. We're getting to that. It's one step at a time. Now, the mode of goodness, which is a clear sober status of understanding, personality of body, which is called Vasudeva, or consciousness, becomes manifest in the Mahatattva. Okay. Mode of goodness, clear sober status of understanding, the personality of Godhead. Now, we are starting to discuss the four expansions of the Lord. Vasudeva, Arjuna and Garuda, Sankarshan, their reappearance in the Mahatattva, who's seated as the super soul. He who is seated within as the super soul expands first as Vasudeva, Srila Prabhupada says in the purport, verse 21. So we have the Lord is there as a super soul. His consciousness is expanded throughout the Mahatattva, and of course we have the living entities there as well. And as far as Vasudeva is the pure all-pervading consciousness, the living entities, their consciousness when it's pure is the Vasudeva platform of consciousness.
Prabhu?
Yeah.
It somewhere said that pure goodness is the Vasudeva stage.
Yes.
It's not the Vasudeva. Vasudeva actually expands. Vasudeva is Krishna.
Yeah, Vasudeva is the super soul.
Super soul.
Okay. So, what you have to understand here, of course, is that there's no false ego. The living entities haven't actually been united with the false ego to one degree or another, because the Mahatattva will actually manifest the false ego. That's the first element that's manifested. But consciousness is there, without, at least for a brief moment, without being attached, or influenced, covered by the false ego to some degree. The consciousness is there.
Sorry,
the Lord, it's just in a state of it's there with its consciousness, floating around in the Mahatattva.
So the jiva is not aware of
that. What's
that? The jiva is not aware, he's not conscious. He's conscious in one sense, but he's dormant.
Yeah, it's just consciousness.
Yeah, the status of the jiva at the time is.
Let's say he's aware, but he's not aware of anything in particular. the living entity is not focusing on any sense objects that haven't been manifest yet. He's not identifying with the body, which he doesn't have. The consciousness is there.
But
at the same time, he's covered by the material energy, and therefore, that's called citta. Citta.
It's
a mode of goodness. Well, it's in one sense it's.
But still, it's not a mode of
goodness. Yeah, it's covered by the Mahatattva, but there's no bodily identification as there is with tamas, and there's no particular material desires in one sense, which are manifest, or because there's no rajas. So there's tranquility, conscious of existence, and but it's not consciousness in the spiritual world, it's consciousness in the material energy, so it's citta. The consciousness which is uncovered by the material energy is Vasudeva. The consciousness is pure, it's peaceful.
Mm-hmm.
Chitta, you know, in essence is the Mahatattva. Sometimes you can use Chitta and Mahatattva, you know, interchangeably, in the sense that Chitta is made of Mahatattva. But Chitta is, you know, covered consciousness. If it's covered by, it's covered by the Mahatattva. And it's covering the consciousness in the individual bodies. It doesn't cover the Lord's consciousness. No, so because there's no passion or rajas or material desires or anything, you know, then it's peaceful in that sense. If you want to worship the Lord, that's the state of consciousness you have to come to. That's the state of consciousness you have to return to. So, now what we're going to look at is that, and if you return to that pure consciousness, you'll worship Lord Vasudeva. Because if you return to that pure consciousness, where you're free from the false ego, and you can understand the existence of the Supreme Lord, then you worship Vasudeva, who is the Supreme Lord, the Super Soul. So, Chitta, Ahankara, of course, intelligence and the mind, they have the deities of Vasudeva, Sankrishna, Prajumna, and Aniruddha, respectively. So, Chitta is Vasudeva, Ahankara, Sankrishna, intelligence, Prajumna, and the mind, Aniruddha. And they're worshipped to purify you of those elements. So if you worship the Super Soul, Vasudeva, you become purified. You're already, in one sense, free from false ego. And that allows you to take up worship of Vasudeva, you know, to one degree or another. But then you become free from the liberated from material existence altogether. So you become free from the chitta as well. You become free from covered consciousness as well. You worship Sankarshan to become free from false ego. You worship Rajumna to become free from, you know, entanglement of the senses, and you worship Aniruddha to become free from entanglement of the mind.
And then the second chapter,
yes.
Second chapter. The first one's in the spiritual world.
Yeah. It's Krishna and Balaram expanding the walk. You know, they're the deities, and you know, their presiding deities are also known as Vishnu, Rudra, Brahma, and Chandra. So in other words, you know, Vishnu, you know, if people worship demigods, actually Vishnu is not actually a demigod, but people worship Vishnu as a demigod. You worship Vishnu to understand the position of, you know, Vasudeva, and you worship Rudra to actually come to the position of realization of Sankarshan, because Sankarshan is the presiding deity, is the deity of.
If anyone worships the Supreme Lord as a demigod, will they get anyone?
Well, if they approach Vishnu and begin to worship him, they may in the beginning think he's a demigod, but if they actually hear about Vishnu from proper sources, they will realize that he is, you know, more than a demigod. So in the beginning they may understand, oh, you know, he's in charge of sattva and you know, maintenance in the material world and liberation and this and that. So they may approach him in effect as a demigod, but if they actually approach him and worship him, which is what they do literally in the Varnashram system, you know, many Brahmins, even when they're worshipping you know, Vishnu, Agni and what have you in the five jagus. They are accepting them. Most Brahmins accept Vishnu as like a demigod. So, and in fact, you know, when we chant the Gayatri Mantra, many Brahmins, they either accept that the Gayatri is worshipping Shiva, the fire god, the sun god, or, you know, Vishnu. So, you know, we understand that it's actually, but, you know, someone says, oh, we chant the Gayatri Mantra, don't think, you know, we shouldn't say, oh, they're worshipping Vishnu as well. Yeah. And they may say, yes, we're Vaishnavas, but their main deity of that Gayatri Mantra is Rudra, or the sun god, or the fire god. When they light a sacred fire and chant the Gayatri Mantra, we're worshipping Vishnu as a predominating deity. They're lighting the sacred fire and chanting the Gayatri to worship Shiva or Agni as the principal deity. So in some sense they have that sort of mentality, but if they approach the Vaishnavas, gradually they will be hear the proper philosophy. So some people are innocent. That's what means innocent. Innocent means they don't know. Envious means you tell them and they become envious. No, we will not accept Vishnu as, you know, above Agni. That's envious. Innocent means you explain it to them. Oh, okay, like that. You know, tell me more, let me understand it. Envious, they won't have it. They'll become angry and disturbed. So there's a difference. So if they're envious, yes, that they've got a problem. And they're committing offences. We don't preach to them. We avoid them. If they're innocent, then that's a different thing.
Many are envious.
Many envious, that's right.
Time.
Sorry?
Time. Still waiting to answer the question.
We're almost there. This is probably, you know, one of the most difficult parts of this chapter. It's actually a lot of these things we did cover. Chapter 5, but you know, this is difficult to understand. So, Vasudeva. So, Prabhupada mentioned verse 22. After the manifestation of Mahatattva, these features appear simultaneously as water in its natural state before coming in contact with earth is clear, sweet, and unruffled. So the characteristic traits of pure consciousness are complete serenity, clarity, and freedom from distraction. There's no senses and sense objects for distraction. And therefore there's also a sense of serenity, because, you know, at that, and there's clarity. So, you know, the consciousness is somewhat pure. That's known as citta. Prabhupada says in the purport, the pure status of consciousness or Krishna consciousness exists in the beginning, just after creation. Consciousness is not polluted. Now, you know, we can take these statements in different ways, in that, you know, living entities who are just for the first time being impregnated into the material world, you can imagine, you know, it's, they haven't really fully embraced the false ego and the elements and what have you. That, you know, Krishna consciousness is practically there with some covering. Different souls may have different levels according to how long they've been covered in the material world. I mean, if they've been, you know, reimpregnated and they've been covered in the material world for millions and millions of lifetimes, then, you know, their consciousness is somewhat pure and unagitated and peaceful here. But, you know, to some degree, if you've just entered the material world, you know, then literally your consciousness will have, you know, some degree of, you know, Krishna consciousness or God consciousness.
So which means for every time that they enter the world after annihilation, they have a pure consciousness, is it? after the annihilation they go back into the body of Vishnu.
Yeah, that's why it's said, you know, it states in the Bhagavatam that, you know, each jiva, that when they first come to the material world, they take the position of Brahma.
Repeated birth.
It's inconceivable. It's
not known when it started, isn't it?
Yeah. Nityabada, you know, there's no trace there. But you know, we do have to understand that there are different degrees of, you know, it's a general state of pure consciousness at this point, according to, you know, when they've entered the material world. They've just fallen, they've been here for billions of years. But to this point, we have to understand that this living entity is in its most pure state at this point. According to, you know.
My question is, is it for the first time that they fall down, or every subsequent time?
Some are coming for the first time, some are for the first time, some have been here for ages. But at this point, they're in, you know, so if they've been in material existence for billions and millions of lifetimes, especially if the last birth was, you know, a worm in stool, preaching Mahavada philosophy, you know, this is at their, you know, most pure state, you know, before they become a worm in stool again. But, you know, for others, they may have actually come from Brahmana, they may have come, from, you know, they may have risen up to Brahma Jyoti and then fallen down again, you know. Or, you know, so, but this is, let's just take this, there's varying degrees of them being in the most pure state of consciousness at this point.
Before the karma is being added on to them. Does anyone, that's the same?
Yeah, before they're actually really covered by the false ego.
So before they get the body.
Before the first part of the body is the false ego. That's the most subtle part of the false ego. So,
during so it's not necessary that everyone purifies after annihilation. They just go back in and they fall.
Yeah, some come in and out. Prabhupada says here, in pure consciousness one can perceive a slight reflection of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. At this point, you know, the living entities, you know, are able to see some, you know, aspect of the Lord, you know, they can see, sense His presence, you know, to some degree. That's, you know, that's Krishna consciousness, to one degree or another. Because of the, you know, the lack of the material covering, you know, it's so subtle, it's, you know, it's just a slight veil over the consciousness. Not when, you know, false ego comes, it really, it's like throwing a wet blanket, you know, you can't see anything. So, this is a chitta. Now, the material ego springs up from the Mahatattva. And ego is predominantly with active power of three kinds: goodness, passion, and ignorance. And it's from these types that the material ego, that the mind, the senses and perception, the organs of actions, and the gross elements evolve. Alright? Now, if you want to go into it a bit more in your further studies, you have to understand that Jnana Kriya and Dravya Shaktis, you know, in that mix, making these distinctions. We're not going to go into that just now.
Any what?
Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur. And, you know, we discussed it in chapter 5.
Okay.
I mean, you can actually listen to what we discussed in those, because I discussed it a fair bit, and but his commentaries to these verses brings it up again. So verses 23, 24.
Jnana, Kriya,
and Dravya. You know, so if you really want to understand the connection between the spiritual energy and how these modes you know, manifest in their qualities, and that's the sort of thing you need to look at, those different shaktis.
And these terms are used a little bit in the fifth chapter, Kalpa Purnasama.
Yeah. Okay. The predominating deity of situated there within the Ahankara is Sankarsha. Sankarsan, you know, is therefore also the cause of the mind, the senses, and the gross elements, because he's the predominating deity of the Ahankara. Now, the false ego is characterized as the doer, an instrument, and as an effect. The doer, the demigods, an instrument, the senses, and effect, the material elements. And, you know, it's further characterized as serene, active, or dull, you know, the three modes of material nature. So these are the different characteristics of that are manifested as a result of the false ego. Now, from the false ego, another transformation takes place. From this evolves the mind. His thoughts and reflections give rise to desire. Now, the mind's general from the mind's general desire to possess objects. You know, different desires for particular objects appear. We desire that which is favourable to our sense gratification, and we reject that which is not favourable. The mind is like a mirror, in one sense, that, you know, the material image appears reflected on our consciousness. The material objects appears reflected on our consciousness. You know, just like an object reflects on a mirror. And then, you know, we see something, and then we, you know, what is there? You know, just like. Sometimes you see lights, you know, if you have a prism and you see coloured lights reflecting on the wall, you know, the light needs something to reflect on, then you know it's there. Actually, you can't see the prism light until it actually reflects on something. So you have a prism and it may be shining, but until it actually hits a wall or an object, you can't actually see that light. So, you know, the mind is something like that. The object reflects on it, it appears there, and then we meditate upon it, and then we get desires, and then there's a bunch of objects coming, one here, there's one there, and we're looking around and we think, oh, I like that one, I'm not so happy about that one, I want that, you know, like that. So this is this acceptance and rejection of the mind. And of course, the mind of the living entity is known by the name of Aniruddha. So we're lucky to have him as a temple president. Aniruddha does, and of course, the Lord Aniruddha. The supreme ruler of the senses, like that. And the yogis meditate upon him to control the mind. You know, the yogis to fix the mind. You know, therefore, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, you know, chanting Hare Krishna cleanses the dust of the mirror of the mind. Because these, the material objects, they reflect upon the mind, but they also create impressions that don't leave, you know. Some scars that can last for many lifetimes. So by meditating upon Aniruddha, one can become free from the agitation of acceptance and rejection. We see that people who don't fix their mind upon Krishna their minds are constantly, you know, trying, going from here. They can never fix their mind on one particular subject. So then, false ego and passion, intelligence takes birth, and the functions of the intelligence is to help ascertaining the nature of objects when they come into view and to help the senses. Now, there's a very nice commentary by Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur who sums all of this up. It's his commentary to this verse, chapter 26, verse 29. I'll read the whole thing. It's only a short purport, but it is a wonderful purport to just make everything very clear. To make a distinction from citta, buddhi is described as vijnana, that which manifests an object. But because it is also awareness, it is said to be a quality of citta. So when there's awareness, we're talking about citta. We're aware of something. We're conscious of something. So intelligence has that quality as well. It's also aware of something, but more. Buddhi shows intelligence, or buddhi shows favour to the senses. Without buddhi, the five senses cannot operate. Even though citta, ahankara and mind also assist the senses, buddhi gives special assistance. Intelligence is a special force that the senses need for them to operate. You know, this must be done, that should not be done. By buddhi, I really, here we listen to this. When I hear a sound, so we're hearing some drums, first, it is registered by citta as simply awareness. So, you know, when I was talking to you, there's a sound which I'm aware of, but then when I focused on it, I realized, oh, that's actually a drum. So there's a difference between being aware of the sound and then the intelligence saying, oh, that's actually a drum. You know, first it's just, you know, what is that noise? So then, by buddhi I realize this is a sound. By the mind I develop a desire for the sound. So I can either, then the mind says, you know, I would like them either to stop, or I'm really enjoying the sound of that madanga. So the mind is then accepted or rejected. And by ahankara, it is related to one's identity. Like that. So, oh yes, I'm a devotee. You know, they're playing madangas, and you know, somehow or another, or you know, if we, you know, some we hear a brass band going up the street, you know, we don't identify it with, well, you know, I'm not going to join the brass band, so we, so according to how it identifies with our particular identity, this is also mingled in there with what we're going to accept and reject. So, everyone get that?
So intelligence is mindful, or it is different?
Different. So there's citta, awareness, intelligence, whereby it helps the senses, assists them, and also it helps to ascertain the nature of the object. So, you know, we're aware of so many things, and intelligence says, that is a sound, that is a fragrance, you know, that is a... So our intelligence is then distinguishing between all the things that we're aware of. And then it assists the senses to interact with those objects in one way or another. The mind literally reflects, it does reflect, you know, in other words, the we have a, you know, like even hearing that sound, I'm actually picturing someone playing a drum. So there's a reflection, or you know, something of that object very subtly on the mind, and then I'm accepting or rejecting.
So it's like a background mind, like an organ on which reflection
is being
done, and then intelligence
is acting or rejecting. Yeah, accepting and rejecting, yeah. Yeah, and ego is what relates it to, you know, the one's identity. Okay? Just one more thing. Doubt? You know, we see that doubt, misapprehension, correct apprehension, memory and sleep, they're also part, functions of intelligence. Rather, like sleep. Actually, I was studying this really late last night, and I was getting tired, and I read this verse, and I said, I'm going to bed, because, you know, I can't think anymore. You know, this exact verse. You know, if you don't sleep properly, your intelligence won't function. You know, you have to have a certain amount of sleep. Doubt is good in the beginning, as Prabhupada says. You know, we doubt. Am I this body? Or am I something different? That is the cause of our intelligence kicking into action. Doubt is good. Doubt is good in the beginning to spur our intelligence to question what have you. But then if we're actually receiving the proper information, we shouldn't doubt then. And, you know, there is misapprehension, we're receiving correct information, or we're receiving correct information, but our intelligence is not functioning properly, and we're misapprehending what we're receiving. So these are all different aspects. All right, so we'll leave it there. I'd like to say most of the rest of the chapter we covered when we did chapter 5 of the second canto. What I'd like you to do is to, you know, of course, make sure that you have read all this. If any of the students you know, want more information, please listen to those lectures, you know, discussions on the second canto, chapter 5. You'll work out which unit is in there.
Yep.
And if you have specific questions upon that, you know, the rest of this part, then bring it up next week at the beginning of the chapter, at the beginning of the lesson. And we'll go over. So I'll go over it very briefly, and if you have some specific questions because you haven't covered enough or haven't understood it, then ask me. If you don't ask me, I'm just going to move through to the next section.
So that 2.5 includes all the Dravya
for the effect. Yes.
What you say, this not has a lot of impact. In, like, for example, how do we, what do we expose the young kids? Like, now, there is a big missing among the devotees, not to expose the kids to tea.
Yes.
That gives, you know, as you said, the mind forms an expression, you form the desire and all that sort of thing.
Yes.
But then, that is, the problem is, what if you're anyway exposed to it because you're in this material world? Somehow you're exposed to it. That even in the temples, I've seen small kids talking about this video, that video, the phone, and all this
like
thing. Even if you're protecting your child so that you're not exposed to all those things, that's the correct way to go about it.
You have to. Consider that one, the children will be exposed to these things because, you know, the world is full of them. But if we make too hard a stance on the children that no, you cannot watch this, they will get to a certain age and rebel, and they'll watch it 100 times more than you want them to because you've held them back from it, you know. So that happens. Sometimes if there's sort of, it's not made such a big issue, but you know, you're very careful how you deal with it, then they don't become too fanatical about it. It doesn't become such a big thing in their life, and it sort of can be supervised by the parents. But you know, usually what, you know, if there's a too hard a prohibition against anything, we see that many of the children grow up and they become rebellious. And they want that 100 times more than they should. More visit because they could never have them. So, yes, we have to be very careful, but at the same time, you know, very careful in the way that we, you know, sort of, be too strict upon the children that they rebel against them. It's sort of like riding a horse. You know, you just gradually pull it up rather than jerk at the, you know, the reins.
Do you want to turn this off?